The Daily Buzz is made possible with support from Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time. A trip to SMG is unlike any other entertainment experience. Whether you come early or stay late, we'll set the mood for a great night to socialize and connect with an immersive movie-going experience. And independent filmmakers, you can four-wall your film or find a home at the many film festivals they host in their 30 locations across the country. And Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. In today's heads-down society, people crave relevance, emotional connection, and honest information. Our pioneering search-first process delivers the credible insights for informed marketing communications. You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW.org, MovieCityNews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This is Day 10. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location in Park City, Utah, at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from the Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of the year's most important and exciting voices in the independent film world. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts Minji Chang and Lanzia Wan, and today we'll be talking about the Sundance documentary The Last Race with the film's director Michael Dweck, and the indie episodic Halfway There with director Rick Rosenthal, writer Nick Morton, and stars Matthew Lillard and Sarah Shahi, as well as a special Women in Documentary segment with Brown Girls Doc Mafia founders Yabo Boyd and Sinan Kashki. And welcome back to The Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Chang. And we are joined by the co-founders of Brown Girls Mafia. We have Yabo Boyd and Sinan Kashki. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, Minji, you want to start us off on this one?
Well, I'm so excited to be sitting with you. And we've been talking with a number of filmmakers and artists and organizers and producers. And we just want to hear more about your program. So can you share a little bit about everything you're doing?
Sure. So, sorry, I lost my voice already.
Haven't we all?
by this point in the fest, we all have.
We're chugging ginger lemon is just not working. So Brown Girls Doc Mafia is a collective of women of color who work in documentary from really around the world, East Coast, West Coast, and we have over 1,400 members now, which is really insane because, you know, the story that we tell ourselves in this industry about diversity is that there is none, especially when it comes to women of color. And we're just sort of trying to break down that that tokenism. But we have, for the last 2 years actually, had a very like private underground incubator just between ourselves, sort of addressing the challenges and the opportunities that we're facing for documentary and creating community, exchanging resources and jobs and having really difficult conversations in a private space, in a safe space between us. And then just this last month, we've sort of gone public-ish and are starting to engage with the industry more intentionally and invite allies to begin having a conversation about how we can collaborate and what's the best way for them to approach us and how we can work with them. Because ultimately the goal is to, you know, sort of infiltrate the documentary community in a way that's going to improve it in the ways that everyone is trying to create more diversity in our work. Yeah.
Well, Sinan, I love that I was talking about, you know, the fact that rather than just talking about that, the whole purpose of this is to literally not just offer encouragement, but to do the concrete measures to really get things made and bring people together. Can you talk about that? You know, talk about it a little bit in detail, because, you know, oftentimes we'll introduce something and we'll go, what are they actually doing? What are they really doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've been working in the documentary industry space for about 10 years now. When I started, there were very few people that I felt I could just go to as a mentor from my community. But what I did find was that the documentary community was so welcoming and so engaging. And so I found that mentorship was the way that I felt like I could find my voice as an artist. And it was a very powerful thing because anytime I had these moments of, you know, is it me or is it, you know, is it the industry? Is it filmmaking? There was always somebody there to support me. And I was hoping for that to continue as the industry changes and as more and more women and people of color come into the space. I was always sort of looking for that group. And there was a moment on Facebook where did you post it, Yaba? The photograph of a group of women at Tribeca. And I saw it, and it was such an inspiring photograph of a group of...
Good pitch, actually.
Good pitch. And I just was like, this is amazing. Like, we should have this kind of a gathering. I wish I had been there. And people were writing on Facebook about it. And so I said, well, let's just... Let's call it something, and let's start a Facebook page. And I called it They See Girls, and because it originally had said Black Girls Doc Mafia, and I was like, oh well, we'll call it They See Girls because They See is the South Asians. And then I was like, well, let's call it Brown Girls because then it's more encompassing. And when we started it, it sort of was just like, the people in the photograph, and then the people in the photograph added people, and then it started to spread. And within, a few months, we had, hundreds of people asking to join. So I don't know how the word spread, but I think there was a moment where everybody felt like there was a need for this voice.
Right.
And it was the best thing, I think, to keep it kind of private and safe for a while. Yeah.
So filmmakers are bringing projects... Or they may just I kind of want to do this and don't really have a direction to it, and then you'll pair them up with mentors. I mean, just how is it happening with the mafia?
It's not a program, it's not, quote unquote, like
right.
that. It's a community.
Okay.
It's a collective.
Okay.
So, and it's not just filmmakers. It's everyone in the industry who is a woman of color who works in doc. So it can be anyone who just graduated from film school and is trying to find a community, through veterans who have been in the business for, 30 years, who are making their eighth film, to someone who is a distributor and is isolated in her world in distribution or as a film programmer, et cetera. So that's what makes us a little bit different from, or a lot different from, organizations, that we also include the industry folks, because there's a lack of diversity on that side as well. It's not just about filmmakers, and we're trying to create those inroads organically.
And so there's a lot of discussion that happens about what's happening in the industry, but what's happening in our world. But then there's also a database component to it, where if you're looking to hire someone consciously, you can go to that space and say, I'm looking for a woman to help me with this project or the other project, or I'm looking for a producer to work with. And so that's been a really great space to be able to go to directly. And I think a lot of people were excited about having access to that information.
I think that's an incredible tool. I think there's, people want to move in the right direction. They want to be active and doing something concrete, and they just don't know where to start. They don't know what resources are available. So the fact that that's something that exists thanks to this collective work is incredible. And I want to touch upon what you're talking about. I mean, certainly, speaking of the industry, we're very familiar with all of the discussion, the conversation that's been gaining such momentum and has made major breakthroughs for a lot of women and women of color, everybody in the industry, to like have this paradigm shift really in what we will and will not tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, I think it's really beautiful that you've created this safe space for people to talk openly about their issues. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you can share? Because you mentioned that there are certain obstacles and challenges that are unique to this community that benefits from that safe space. Are you able to share anything now that you're going more public-ish with this organization? 1,400 members, it's amazing.
I think we are so focused on the work and trying to make the things that we're making, to take steps forward. I mean, there's, of course, a lot of conversations about political stuff, what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. Of course, Me Too and Trump and everything. And it's practical, like, hey, can I get advice on this legal issue, or I need help in this country that I don't know? With all that practical stuff. But I think, like a lot of women around the world, we're just trying to put our heads down and move forward and stop having these things sort of like getting in the way. So it's very hands-on, like, how do I move this project forward? I need your support. How can we support each other, kind of thing.
Mm.
And that feels good, I think,
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, as the smoke continues to clear or not clear, the most important thing is that these films rise to the top and get the attention that they deserve, and so that we're making the practical momentum of women filmmakers getting more attention, getting more financing, more distribution, more festival programming, and that we're finding ways to topple the white male industry as much as we can, getting people in higher executive positions, having more financial decision-making power, et cetera, et cetera. So we're just kind of like, get your head down and keep moving, girl, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately, it's about empowerment.
Right. And we're going to keep our head down and keep on moving with the show. It's fantastic talking with you both. Again, Yabo Boyd and Sunanda Kashki from Brown Girls Doc Mafia. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for
having us.
Thanks
for inviting us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Cheng. And right now we're going to talk about the film The Last Race. This is screening in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance. We have the director with us, Michael Dweck. Michael, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, we want to get into this. And of course, we always like to lead off by having our filmmakers introduce our audience to the film. So tell us what The Last Race is about.
Well, it's a cinematic portrait of a local Long Island racetrack, and the drivers that call it home, and they're kind of struggling to keep this piece of Americana alive while this real estate boom kind of just creeps its way in.
Yeah, that just kind of encroaches on them.
Right? Yeah, it's a beautiful story. I mean, the track is the last remaining type of, you know, the country. It's built in 1949. It's the last one that races real stock cars from the 1970s. So these are hardworking, middle-class laborers, mechanics, you know, grease monkeys, tow truck operators that, you know, have kept these cars alive since they were kids. And, you know, every night they work in their cars, and come Saturday night, you watch these guys transform from ordinary people to heroes in front of an audience of 1,000 people to win, like, a $7 trophy.
I think it's a really... I don't know. It's just a peek into a different world. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's the beauty of all these films that we get to see at festivals like Sundance, and having documentaries just take you through that journey of everything you're just reflecting upon. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious, how did you come across the topic? Is that part of your world? Did you grow up in
that? It is. It's my world. I was raised in Long Island. I was raised next to a stock car racetrack. Mm-hmm. There used to be 40 of them. And
wow.
And I was watching them. So the first one I got paved over was the one next to my house. But I was going there from when I was 3 until I was 18, went to college, and I would go there every Tuesday and Friday with my parents and to watch my heroes. I mean, I'd watch, you know, it was you know, loud, it was dangerous, it was violent, it was, you know, alive. And then I get, at the end of the night, I go into the pits and with my, you know, my little pen, and I get autographs from these guys who I never really talked to. They were just kind of these heroes of mine. And that closed in 1986. It was replaced by a Costco. And then slowly, one by one, they were all being paved over until there was only one. And I'm a fine art photographer, and I decided at Riverhead Raceway I was going to devote 5 years, set up a studio there, and document it photographically. So I set up an 8x10 camera and started to photograph the cars first, and then the car components. I cut these cars apart, sandblast them, and then... just photograph all these pieces. I realized this is not, we don't make cars anymore out of metal anyway, so I wanted to just memorialize that. And then I realized that I couldn't capture the emotion or the motion of this place properly without thinking of motion picture. And that's why I decided a documentary. And then that was another 5 years creating a documentary.
And then who knows how that 5 years plays out, right? You're doing five years of documentary, and you're saying that's the last standing.
Yeah.
Raceway, and you don't know what's going to happen to that, and there's all this development happening. I think that storyline is very present in not just talking with the developers, you get to mm-hmm. include them in the documentary, but also the people who are affected by it, right? And generationally, these are...
Oh, 100%. You have 3 generations in a race. Mm-hmm. You have grandson, son, grandfather racing against each other in a race. And, you know, it's all out.
They don't hold back.
You know, you're talking about 100 mile an hour and a quarter mile track, 35 cars that are allowed to make contact. You know, they weigh 4,200 pounds. These are Cadillacs and Eldorados. But the story, you know, this is a community. These are all people that don't spend their days texting and be on phones. These are people that just, in this place, it's almost like their church. This is the place where everybody's equal. And you have a lot of people that are volunteers. In the film, there's a videographer who's 75, is a postal worker. He's been there 30 years, and this is his deal. He videotapes the drivers when they make their speech, get their trophy, makes a DVD, gives it to you for a dollar. You know, you have the announcer who's been sitting in that booth since he was 16 or 17 and he's 68. You know, every day, that's his world. That's what gives his life meaning, and it's all tied to identity. Mm-hmm. But this is happening all over the country. It's a national, it's not about racing, really. It's about the loss of community. It's about the world becoming more disconnected. And when you become more disconnected, you become less empathetic. You care about things less in general, and that's kind of what's happening. So, you know, it's important that places like this stay around because, you have it's very difficult to find places where it gives your life meaning. Especially for people that don't have a lot, you know, people that don't, that, you know, always battling about not getting ahead,
right,
and feeling frustrated where things are happening, and you have places like this that that, you know, help them feel like human again,
right.
And it's for the audience as well. It's good to feel these visceral emotions.
That spans a lot of different emotions too. I think it's really you speak about community and feeling connection and being in person with one another and celebrating this thing that we all love. But you also show the grittier side, obviously.
Yeah.
these men getting in fist fights with
one another on the
racetrack. And there's value in that as well.
Yeah. Like they're passionate.
Having human contact and
It's human. That's what you feel. You feel that not just for the drivers but for the audience. I was an audience member for years. And even I went, you know, finally after I finished shooting, I went to watch a race as an audience member. But you feel alive. I mean, it's something about being there where the ground shakes and the cars are going by and the rubber's, well, my hair, the rubber's getting, you know, stuck in your hair and the fuel they use, it sticks to your skin for days. Your ears are ringing for a week until the next week. You know, but it's something about that. There's something that makes you feel alive. It's like the way gladiators were. You know, gladiators were way back. What they gave to a community is a sense of, you know, rivalry and reward and theater. This is kind of what this is. And as an artist, it made me seem like it was performance art. They're hand-painted cars, and they have, like, folk art on them. They're names of their girlfriends, their wives, their brothers, their mothers who have passed away on the car. And it's very much they identify with that. They wear their team shirts. The crew comes out. There's 8 crew members that just have, you know, the number of the car in there. They take it very seriously.
Well, we don't have a lot of time left, but I also wanted to have you talk about the fact, because you were a fine art photographer, a fine art photographer, and how that transition was, how, you know, moving from that to, you know, directing live action, mm-hmm. and literally from the photography aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
and what surprised you. And having that, you know, as a tool, you know, what did you see any limitations with it? What was that?
Well, it was a bit easier photographically. It's easier, although the cars are racing around the pits and they didn't really want me around there. But I wanted the way I want to shoot this documentary is very much like my photographs. I wanted to sit, plan a shot, wait for the light to be perfect, and shoot. And that doesn't work in chaos.
That never happens.
Chaos doesn't work. So I'd say I have a you know, a car, and I'd say, okay, I'm waiting and I'm waiting. I said, so it's okay, I'm just gonna, you know, wait here and wait until you climb into the car at 4:30. Is that okay? Yeah, no problem. All of a sudden, race time, they change. They're in the zone and they're like, get this, look at the animal, get it out. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but I'm gonna get it. And they just pull out over the camera, you know. So it's but I think, you know, but as a director, it was hard because to not be tempted to just shoot everything. Mm-hmm. I decided I had to wait. I didn't want to start. If there was some action that was there, it just didn't look right, I decided not to do it. The light wasn't right, I decided not to do it. So that was very difficult. Patience.
Well, but, you know, it's amazing to capture this. Again, the film is The Last Race, which screens in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance. We've been talking to Michael Dweck, the director of this. Michael, it's nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman, and right now we are talking about the indie episodic Halfway There, which is screening at Sundance, and we've got a full team here. And, you know, because I'm just going to be entertained the majority of this segment, I know, I'm going to let you guys introduce yourselves. So, Nick, let's start with you.
I'm Nick Morton. I'm the screenwriter.
Ow! Yow!
Matthew sitting next to me?
My name is Matthew Lillard.
Okay. Sarah?
Sarah. My name is Sarah Shahi. I'm an actress.
And Rick.
My name is Rick Rosenthal, and I try to be the camp director.
Okay. And as camp director, I always like to let our filmmakers introduce the audience to the films and the projects. So, Rick, tell us what Halfway There is.
We have a half-hour pilot called Halfway There about a sober living facility run by a character named Jimmy Bishop, played by none other than the incomparable Matthew Lillard.
Such a good word. Did you go to Harvard?
And it's a difficult task, as you can hear in the background, just wrangling not only Matthew, but Sarah and our stellar group of actors, not to mention a writer who, you know, comes in all the time and says, I don't really think that's the way we should do it.
So you actually allowed the writer on set, which rarely happens for a director, Rick. Let's talk with Nick here, and let's talk about you know, writing this and you know, and where the inspiration came from.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was someone that was actually close to both Rick and I who ended up in a sober living house, and at the time we were interested in getting involved in some television, and we thought this would be a great idea for a show. And then I had the good fortune to get sober, and after some time being sober, I was like, you know, this is a show I actually really want to write. And, you know, really at the heart of the show is Jimmy Bishop's relationship with his mom, who's played by Blythe Danner. And, you know, for me personally, so much of, like, getting sober was just, like, growing up and learning to sort of, like, take responsibility for, like, my own decisions sort of outside the influence of my parents. And I think that that is something that we watched Jimmy in the course of the pilot and throughout the series sort of struggle with, to feel, like, what is it in his life that really, really counts.
All right. There's a balance. The balance that you have to strike, because you have a great cast, a very entertaining cast, as I'm experiencing right now.
Well, not right this second. I'm trying to be quiet.
At this very second.
I'm trying to let people sound real smart so that people are interested in what we're doing.
But we're dealing with serious subjects, and literally life and death stuff, you know, and yet you're also, you know, there's a very, you know, entertaining, you know, there's some fun stuff there, you know, whether it's stuff that, you know, between Matthew and Issei Morales, whether, you know, there's fun stuff as well.
I think, like, certainly in the world of, like, addiction and recovery, like, the stakes are incredibly high, and the I think often the only way to deal with it is to laugh. You know, if you sort of lose your laugh, you lose your footing. And I think you see so much of that, and I mean, so much of it in just, like, how Matthew Lillard as a human goes through his life, and why he fits the role of Jimmy Bishop so well, to kind of deal with, you know, dispelling the tensions and the, you know, sometimes the tragic consequences of bad decisions through, you know, sometimes just being the guy who can still bring some light to a otherwise dark situation.
And Rick, you've got to manage all these people on set.
Yeah, I mean, we've known Mr. Lillard for a long time. We did a film with him called Fat Kid Rules the World, and
Fat kid?
All right.
No, I'm just asking.
He used to be a fat kid.
I love a little bit of extra. I don't mind a little bit of extra. It keeps me warm in the winter. It gets shade in the summer. Wow. I don't mind.
Put it on, dude.
I missed that one.
Yeah, but as you can see, it takes a lot to wrangle all of these, and then multiply this by Issei Morales.
I was not like this on set, by the way. Yeah. It was very good.
Everybody on set disclaims the fact that they ever talked. It was the noisiest set I have ever been on in my life.
But why? Why was it noisy?
Well, one reason was Matthew Lillard talked a lot.
That is not true. Why was it
really Issei noisy? Morales talked a lot.
Issei Morales.
Yes, he does. I've worked with
sure
him on something other than this.
Yes. And, yeah. He is like
Matt O'Leary was a cheerleader.
Yeah. But people loved each other. I mean,
it was a fantastic set. And everybody that worked on it has some interesting history. Sitting on my left, Sarah Shahi, whom I met in 2001, she auditioned for me, and I loved her, but she wasn't right for the part. And
so I went in eight times.
Eight times. And still didn't get it?
Still didn't get it.
And we talked about her almost every day. And,
dude, you totally owed her.
And I did, right. So 17 years later, when the part became available as Matthew Lillard's Jimmy Bishop's ex-girlfriend, I immediately said, without even thinking, you know, this actress, Sarah Shahi, And so the first day,
owe her one.
Yeah, the first day on the set, she came bounding out of her room, and she came down. I was thinking, oh, I'm going to have to reintroduce myself. She said, "Rick, I met you in 2001." And I said, "Yeah. Here's what's so strange. So you thought you didn't get the part?" And she said, "I didn't get the part."
Yeah, I didn't shoot that.
I know.
Yeah.
But I said, "Yeah, you didn't get the part then, but it just took. You actually did get the part. It just took 17 years. So that was, you know, that was an incredible delight." And I couldn't have been more thrilled with what she brought to the table. Isai Morales, I worked with on Bad Boys in 1982. And I worked with him one other time between now and the pilot. Then in the pilot. My daughter is plays a part of a young woman looking to maybe come to the halfway house, maybe not. And her parents are played by two actors, one of whom I worked with in 1986 and the other I worked with in 1998. And they adopted her and became her surrogate parents. I mean, it was just an incredible group of
people. Rick, are all these names like on an old school Rolodex that you still use?
No, you know, they're people that I've pretty much stayed in touch with. You know, early on I worked with a cameraman named Bruce Surtees, and he was Clint Eastwood's DP. Is Clint's first DP, and he was Clint's DP for years and years and years. And I would hear stories from him about the camaraderie of the family that used to work with Clint. And that became, for me, an early goal of sort of having a repertory company. And that was both crew and actors. And we've pretty much done that. I mean, the guy who was the first AD came out of retirement to AD the show. And, you know, Nick and I have been working together for longer than
we don't like to talk about
when I used to have hair, I think.
Wait, now, when I was still drinking.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, but one thing I also wanted to talk with you guys about is the fact that this is premiering at Sundance. And, you know, how our projects are made and are seen now are so vastly different. As far as streaming content and how, and you know, there are, you know, TV series are now, you know, at film festivals, and, you know, it's not just the three networks of yore now. So, like all of you, each of you kind of touched that from your perspective, you know, both, you know, acting in projects, how you take on stuff to go, well, you know, I'm doing a film, but then I'm doing this little streaming, like webisode series, you know, or I'm doing this series and we're here at Sundance and now it may go two series because of that.
Well, yeah, I think that it's a really exciting time in storytelling, right? As an actor, to be a part of a project that goes 10 episodes or goes 3 years, and you get to dig in. There's more hours, there's more time, there's more nuance, the stories are deeper and richer. So as an actor, it's really exciting. Also, you know, I think that I always try to remind people, you know, the acting is easy. It's the time in between jobs that's really tough. And the great thing that's happening now in the creation of content, this explosion of creativity, is that there is more work. And just the idea that you have more opportunity to get yourself to the next job. And as a blue-collar sort of working-class actor, I think that's exciting. And I think that the industry needs it.
Nick is a writer.
Yep. I mean, I'm a writer and a producer. I do stand-up comedy. And, I mean, I think that, like, I think part of the key to longevity in Hollywood is being able to, you know, do a bunch of things so that when one thing's going badly, there's something else that's exciting you, and that, you know, the stream of opportunities is wider. And I also think it's exciting that, like, the stigma of, you know, different kinds of content has kind of come off. It doesn't really, you know, it's like, tell a great story, and if that's a series of 3-minute shorts, great. If that's a, you know, 90-minute movie, great. And I think as a, you know, as a writer or content creator, it just gives you more options to say, oh, I have this idea. It would be a great short. Let's make it as a short and not feel like it has to be something else.
And Sarah, does that, I mean, as an actor, does that, do you have a little sense more of empowerment because there are more opportunities and all kinds of avenues for you to, you know, to potentially work in?
I think so. I mean, just, you know, kind of piggybacking on what Nick and Matt said, it's just one of those, it's a very exciting time because there are so many opportunities. And between whether it's cable or network or just, you know, the indie circuits, it's that the time between jobs is getting less, and to find something that's creatively enticing and pushes you to grow, I feel like people are more willing to take, you know, chances in that arena. And as somebody who grew up sort of fantasizing about this, and I still can't believe that I get to call this my living to play make-believe professionally, you know, that's a very exciting thing to be able to say.
Well, again, we've been talking about the indie episodic Halfway There, which is screening at Sundance. And we've had with us Rick Rosenthal, the director, Nick Morton, the writer, and two of the stars of the show, Matthew Lillard and Sarah Shahi. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
I refuse for this to end. I refuse for this to end. I demand another 4 minutes. Come on, man. You have to ask a harder question.
And we're wrapping up Day 10 of the Daily Buzz on kcpw.org, moviecitynews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and the Slam Dance Film Festival. Our sponsors, Studio Movie Grill, which is opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. Additional support is provided by Movie City News, The Market in Park City, Ruby Snap, and City Cakes. Our producer is Lanzia Wan.